Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 365. Thursday, May 14th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So, this requires very little introduction. This is a continuation of the conversation that I recorded with Justin Ritchie. The first part is in Sea Realm Podcast, episode number 557, Planet of the Extra Environmentalists, and this is the conclusion. In that Sea Realm Podcast, where part one of the conversation with Justin Ritchie is to be found, I ended with a monologue, you might call it. I think a rant is probably more appropriate or more accurate. It wasn't scripted out in advance, but I don't know if a monologue needs to be. But anyway, in the end, my frustration with the federal government and state governments, for that matter, came out. Basically, I'm just really pissed off that people have been told they may not go to work, but they're not going to get any help. You know, they still need money. They still have expenses. They still have obligations, but they're not getting sufficient help from the government. And there's no reasonable expectation that if you tell people you can't work, you may not go to work, you may not do the thing you do to earn a living for the foreseeable future. You just can't. And we're not going to give you any money, even though we will open the coffers and give literally trillions of dollars to big business. If you tell people to stop going to work, but you don't provide them with the support they need to obey that order, there is no reasonable expectation that they will obey it. And if they disobey, there's no valid grounds for criticizing them. The rent is still due. People need money. They get money by working. If you are not going to support people who you have kicked out of work, you just have no reasonable expectation that they will obey your orders to not go to work. Let me set the scene for you. Just before I had recorded that outgoing monologue, actually, just before I recorded that outgoing monologue, I had recorded a different version of it, which was even more ranty and angry and intemperate, let's say. And I just deleted that one. I thought about how I might edit it, you know, to remove the most extreme and possibly ill-advised portions of it and still have it flow. And then I decided that would be too much work. I just deleted it and started over, as I often do. But I was in such a mood when I recorded that monologue because I had just finished editing the entire conversation with Justin Ritchie, including the portion you're about to hear. And I will say Justin was clear-eyed and sober, and I was drinking whiskey as we were having this conversation. And in the latter part of the conversation, I had had more whiskey, and my tongue was loosened. So that's what you're about to hear. But even before that, a bit of feedback from that last episode. This comes from Christopher Harrison, who has been a guest on this podcast, and actually fairly recently. So Chris should be a fresh voice in your memory. He writes, "Hi, KMO. I cannot tell you how happy I was to hear Justin Ritchie's voice over the interwebs again after he and Seth so thoughtlessly abandoned the Extra Environmentalist podcast several years ago without even considering how that would impact their long-term listeners." I'm kidding about that last part. Well, sort of. "And it was indeed an excellent and grounded conversation about a topic that so many people have been reacting in such emotional ways. I, for one, have largely steered clear of the buzz around that movie, Planet of the Humans. I haven't watched it. I haven't watched any of the rebuttals to it, aside from Richard Hindberg's written response to it, which I also found to be quite measured and acknowledging some of the arguments made by the filmmaking team while pushing back on other claims of theirs from a place of rationality. But I was most moved by your commentary at the end. I am lucky to be in a position where my household's financial standing is still secure. We have become practiced at living well below our means for years now, and both my wife and I are still employed. But despite my personal position, I increasingly find myself filled with rage and a desire for revenge when I see the manner in which those elected to preside over the federal and state kleptocracies are using the pandemic as an excuse to further enrich those already at the heights of the economy, while turning the screws tighter on everyone else. I heard this state of affairs best described by Irami Osei Frimpong, a.k.a. the Funky Academic, in one of his Rising appearances, when he said that the federal and state governments had conscripted the workforce of the country, and the product that they were having them create was public safety. But they refused to pay the conscripted workforce for this work. When stated that way, I think the patent injustice and unfairness of it all becomes glaringly obvious. Then again, as I said a couple of years back, fairness is largely a middle-class concept. Those at the top know the game is rigged in their favor and work tirelessly to keep it that way. Those at the bottom know the game is rigged against them, and that they have to fight like hell to force any concessions. It is only the comfortable middle class that talks of these things in terms of fairness and unfairness. As a Facebook friend you also know and who appeared on an episode of your podcast said recently, quote, "I alternate between believing we will need a lot of love to get through this and advocating for guillotines," close quote. And I told him that I never felt such alignment with another human being than I did at that statement. It's impossible to not feel like a good culling of the rich and powerful of this country is part of the solution. As for me, I'm taking my relatively secure but soul-deadening job and leaving it in about 6 weeks to dive into a cooperative regenerative farming venture in my community. I had already planned to step away from my engineering job around the end of the year and embark on an ag venture while also diving into the household economy. But a friend of mine, whose dad owns a 29-acre farm that my friend is trying to start up again, approached me about going in on it with him. And I gave my 2 months notice so as to not leave my project in a lurch, and now I'm playing out the string of that transition. David Holmgren advocated for 10 to 20% of the industrial middle and upper middle class to voluntarily opt out of the industrial economy in his Crash on Demand, Welcome to the Brown Tech Future, in order to withdraw their labor and consumption as kind of a last-ditch effort to stop runaway climate change, with the idea that if they did so, that it could crash the global economy, a decision Holmgren did not take lightly. After reading that, I knew that I had to move myself and my family in that direction. So that's part of the work I've been doing, honing my skills and building up needed infrastructure while bringing my family around to supporting this path. And when I read Holmgren's most recent book, Retro Suburbia, I knew I had found a good source on the how to make it happen. Along those lines, I'm also heading up the development of a homesteader's grange in my community as a decentralized network of people to share tech and other skills, and eventually share labor to help each other out with projects to increase their household and/or community resilience. So I've decided to dive down really locally as a means to hopefully help myself and others in our community mitigate the worst impacts of a decrepit economy likely to meet us on the other side of the pandemic. I know that love, patience, trust, and connection are keys to this. Yet every day when I read the national news, I cannot help but think that guillotines and bullets may have a role to play, despite my knowledge of how that is a losing proposition given the government's wholesale monopoly on violence. After years of reading about how societies collapse, I never really thought I'd find myself in the midst of one. Yet, here we are. Best to you, KMO. Chris Harrison, Warwick, New York. All right. Well, I don't know what my plans are in terms of moving to Puerto Rico, but if I'm still here in Vermont a year from now, that's a pretty easy drive down to Warwick, New York. So I would definitely like to go down and investigate and see what Chris Harrison has got cooking in terms of, you know, local community ventures. Once he's, you know, had some time away from the 9-to-5 job. But Chris, thank you very much for this excellent communication. All right, now here's the continuation and conclusion of my conversation with Justin Ritchie. All right. Well, hey, Justin, so you and I know each other because of podcasting and Peak Oil, basically. Yes. Or maybe podcasting and Terrence McKenna. I'm not sure exactly.
Yes, all of the above.
So you've heard me talk to a variety of people about the potential for the collapse of industrial civilization, particularly, you know, as a result of oil supply constraints. And supply outstrips demand by a crazy amount right now. Prices have never been lower, at least not in our lifetimes. The idea that we should be worried about, you know, not having enough oil right now is definitely the least of our problems, or at least so it seems to me. And yet there's a sizable portion of the CBROM audience that doesn't want to hear that. You know, they were very comfortable with the peak oil story, and the idea of having to think about something more complicated is unappealing. And I just wonder what your current relationship is to the whole peak oil narrative.
Yeah, well, so peak oil as a concept was really always about production rates. It was never about prices and markets. And I think what happened, especially in the early 21st century, is those two conversations got confused because we had this spectacular run-up in prices in the 2005 to 2008 timeline, which was driven primarily by the marginal buyer of barrels, which was China. And a lot of what we've thought about commodities from the past 20 years has been actually a result of what's been going on with the massive expansion in China. You know, you hear all these numbers about, oh, there was as much cement consumed in 10 years in China as in 40 years of the United States. You know, these kinds of numbers. I don't know if that's the exact accurate one, but, you know, you hear things like that all the time. Were you going to say something, Kamo?
I'm just nodding, basically okay. Saying the exact figures are unimportant. You're getting the magnitude correct.
Yeah, and so I think that where a lot of people were looking for peak oil in the first few decades of the 21st century, they thought they saw it with that dramatic price run-up and high prices. And that was actually not what peak oil is going to look like in the next few decades. So I'm of the mindset that there is a lot of oil from an absolute perspective. If you were to truly quantify all the types of liquid fuels that we can get out of the ground and then substitutes for those, like actually oil shale, there's a significant amount of them. However, what I do think is going to be happening in the next decade is we are going to be seeing possibly the peak in oil, simply driven by a lack of investment. And that's because the Chinese banking and financial system is a hall of mirrors, and it's incredibly opaque and no one can see into it. And now the whole thing is going to implode, partly because of the geopolitical ramifications of this pandemic that we're living through now, which has a double whammy of challenging China's geopolitical role that they built for themselves since the 1990 expansion started, as well as curtailing, because of the virus itself, transportation demand and so on that would justify further investments in supply, causing us to get into that decline. I do think still the most likely scenario is that bumpy plateau of, you know, that King Hubbert had as a possibility. And I think if you read, there's a really good biography about M. King Hubbert by Mason Inman, who's an energy analyst and energy writer. And I think that goes a long way to dispelling a lot of the outlandish things that people have said about peak oil over the years. And the bumpy plateau scenario was certainly always a possibility that Hubbert had in his original work.
Just right quick, describe the bumpy plateau. I've never heard the adjective bumpy applied to it. I've always heard undulating plateau, but I like bumpy better.
Yeah, undulating plateau. Maybe bumpy plateau was something that I just coined when I looked at it. Maybe I read it somewhere. But effectively, it's just that we're no longer in an expansion phase of oil supply. One of the Hubbert scenarios was this unbelievable run-up of oil production that was similar to the rates of growth in oil production that we'd seen from 1950 to 1970, just extrapolated out. And that's where you get those classic kind of peak oil charts of just like a really sharp peak and then, you know, straight down. But actually, if we ran up to the peak a lot slower, which in effect we have, then the more likely scenario is one of just you know, slow kind of declines and then increases and declines and increases, leading up to an eventual terminal decline of conventional oil production.
I'm going to dig into that just a little bit deeper. The reason why you have the undulations or the bumps on the plateau is that as oil becomes scarce, it increases in price. As it increases in price, people are motivated to either decrease their usage or look for substitutes. As they do that, demand decreases and price decreases. And as price decreases, then people, you know, they take advantage of the lower price and they use it more. And as they use it more, demand increases and the price increases. So you get this, you know, up and down because you've got this varying supply and demand. The supply, you know, is pretty much, the ultimate supply is fixed, but the rate of production can ramp up or down depending on price incentives. But I think what the past few years have demonstrated, particularly this year has really demonstrated that the price of oil is not really, it's not inexorably fixed to demand. And the production rates are not necessarily a strict economic calculus. One of the reasons that we're flooded in oil right now, aside from the fact that nobody's going to work and nobody's driving, is that Russia and Saudi Arabia got into this pissing contest. You know, Saudi Arabia wanted to curtail production, you know, to keep prices up. And Russia said, fuck you, we're going to crank it out. And so we have, like a couple weeks ago, we got to this point where some people had purchased, you know, oil futures. They'd purchased the right to get oil in the future at a certain price. And the price that they could get for it was less than they had committed to pay. So basically we had negative oil prices, you know, for certain types of oil at a particular place. It was a momentary thing, but it was really notable, you know, that oil, at least West Texas Intermediate crude, cost -$30 a barrel, which is to say, if you could haul off, 1,000 barrels of oil to an approved storage facility, they would pay you to take it. There's so much more at work other than just how much is needed and how much we expect we're going to need and how much the need and the relative scarcity is going to set the price.
True, but I think that the bumpy plateau, it's hard to really define what's going to be the narrative that is around all the bumps. So, for example, I think it's very similar to what you see with the stock market in the current pandemic environment, where we've had the most unprecedented shutdown and curtailment of economic activity in modern history. And yet the stock market continues to rally. So you always see headlines on CNBC, you know, market surges on 20 million unemployed when they were actually expecting 21 million unemployed. And it's like, well, you know, the logic of that doesn't really make any sense at all, but it's just because people are sitting back and they're trying to figure out what the headline should be. So they try to throw up some explanation for it because it's actually driven by other things. And so I think that the bumpy plateau, certainly prices factor into it, but it's also just that we've hit this point where, as we were talking about before, in relation to all these feedback elements of property and real estate prices in urban areas that have essentially crushed the hopes of younger people who live in those areas to have larger families, it's this feedback element that's pushing us down from the unsustainable population trends that we've been on. It's the same thing that's going to happen now that we've reached this peak moment of expansion in oil supply. There will be lots of other factors and responses in society that'll be the headline reasons why oil production is falling or expanding in the future. So that's how I see it. It's not simply a market thing, because the way I see it, ever since the 2008 financial crisis, we've been moving away from the market that people, market-based societies that we thought we had lived in, and we're moving towards something that is much more centrally planned markets, where we basically are all converging at 0% cost of money. And, you know, that's no longer the kind of, when people think about free markets of, you know, there's a buyer and seller and they converge at a price, reaching a point where we're basically setting the price of money centrally. We're setting the price of financial assets centrally, where now in today's crisis, we're talking about the next step is for the Federal Reserve to actually be purchasing financial assets directly in order to ensure that there's liquidity. And that's the next step away from what people see as a free market society. You can still, you know, over the last 10 years, you can still kind of squint and see free market things on Wall Street and so on, but it's really been moving so far away from where a quote unquote free market would have been in, say, 1987 when the crash happened.
So I want to point out that during the C-Realm podcast portion of our discussion, you mentioned Donald Trump repeatedly, and you mentioned Bernie Sanders, and I didn't mention any of those people. But now that we're in the vault, let me just say, I'm disgusted with the Democratic Party. I'm fucking disgusted with them. I wish them pain and lingering humiliation and death. I really, really hate the Democratic Party right now. I mean, I've always hated the Republicans, so I'm not in the least bit, you know, surprised or disappointed in their behavior. But over the past decade, really, you know, since, I didn't realize it at the time, I drank the Kool-Aid during, you know, the Bill Clinton years, but now looking back, even Bill Clinton was such a vicious predator, you know, on the working class, basically. And he was a Republican who tried to allow, you know, gays in the military, basically. But the DNC has been so vicious in shutting down the populist insurgency, you know, the populist movement. The people who say, look, you give infinite amount of money and power and privilege and access to the wealthiest members of this society and everybody else in this moment of utter crisis, when you've told us to not go to work, you will give no money to people who have to pay rent. I'm so, so angry. I mean, that's just the groundwork. I'm so angry at the mainstream Democratic Party. But, and you know, the emblematic figures in terms of people who are running, you know, for president and then dropped out when Obama told them to, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. They are all anathema to me. So it irks me. It makes my skin crawl to say that at least on one point, I agree with Amy Klobuchar. You know, there was a debate where Bernie Sanders was just doing his point blank ban fracking period. That's it. No fracking. You know, that's his position. And Amy Klobuchar was trying to make a more nuanced position saying, look, you know, methane, natural gas is a very clean burning fuel. We are awash in it right now because of fracking. To say no more fracking, which is to say no more cheap natural gas, just means we have to ramp up coal production. If you look at energy return on energy investment, if you look at the atmospheric effects of using one fuel source over another, it makes good sense to use natural gas instead of coal. And that's like too nuanced a position for so many people. You know, that just for so many people, there is, oh, Bernie says ban fracking. Fracking is evil. No fracking.
But I'll add there, Kamo, it's that kind of framing of the political discourse that the film Planet of the Humans enters into, right? So it's like once you have, this is why I say that the filmmakers have achieved what they were trying to do, and they actually come out on top in compared to Bill McKibben. It's simply because in a black and white world of ban fracking or we're going all in, you know, let's dig it all up and burn it all, that they are associating environmental leaders with the lack of purity that is that nuanced perspective that you provided, right? So I think if you were to talk to Bill McKibben about what he was thinking when he was doing certain things, there'd be a lot of nuance. But that kind of nuance doesn't fit into the ban fracking type of perspective that resonates with a lot of people. And so that's part of the reason why the political discourse and now extrapolating into the environmental discourse in the United States post Planet of the Humans has become so divisive. It's because we just have this constant spinning of the extremes that get more and more extreme and more stark, as opposed to allowing for any space in between to talk about the reality.
Have you interviewed Bill McKibben?
No, but I've actually spoken with him multiple times. He's come to Vancouver for talks and, interacted with him quite a bit, exchanged emails too after.
I've interviewed Bill McKibben, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. He is the most frustrating interview subject for me because he has his talking points, like stuff he has written out in advance.
Yeah.
He's going to say word for word, and nothing I can do will get him off those talking points. He is the anti-Dmitry Orlov. You know, Dmitry kind of freaks me out with just how wholeheartedly yay Putin he is these days. But Dmitry's a great interview subject in that you can ask him something which is completely off the wall in terms of anything he's written or said elsewhere, and he'll just go for it. He'll just riff and you know, pursue that line of reasoning fearlessly, regardless of, you know, what might come out of his mouth in the process of exploring it. And that is so much fun. And interviewing Bill McKibben, man, it's like pulling teeth. And at the end, you don't have any teeth in your hand. You haven't extracted a single one.
Right. But I think that's that, the element of genuine candor that, is now in the same way I was associating the style of Planet of the Humans with the Trump campaign style, is where the politicians that were attacked by the Trump campaign, such as Hillary, were manufactured in the sense of, you know, meticulously focus grouped, meticulously on point, robotic in the way that the talking points were presented, which is a style that, you know, the Republicans embraced too before, but the DNC seems to have embraced even more now. Very technocratic, top-down perspective to campaigns and choosing candidate. And the Bill McKibben approach to environmental campaigning, if you're going to be an effective environmental campaigner, that's exactly what you have to do. You have to have a focus group, workshop, bullet points, and no matter who you're talking to, you come down and you say each of those points time and again. And you have to practice them in the mirror time and again if you're Bill McKibben, because whether you're on Stephen Colbert or you're on any other kind of setting, you have to be able to roll off those bullet points. And so it's what Planet of the Humans is doing again is it's attacking that kind of style of campaigning.
You know, Planet of the Humans, it wouldn't have made any sort of splash, as far as I'm concerned, without the name Michael Moore attached to it, you know, in much larger font than, you know, the actual people who made the thing. I just don't think that it would have, you know, made any sort of splash without that name. And yet, I think if Michael Moore takes an interest, you know, he has access to funding sources. Planet of the Humans seems like such a shoestring sort of production and so long in the making, that if Michael Moore is going to put his name on it, he might as well like throw a couple million dollars at it, you know, and get some nice graphics and some animation and maybe some professional voiceover, or, you know, put some polish on it and bring it up to date. It was so strange to me to see this huge name, Michael Moore, put across this documentary, which I'm riffing off somebody who left a YouTube comment for me, but you know, it's like a JFK conspiracy or Area 51 sort of video. I mean, the production quality is, I don't want to hold up production quality or production value as the end all be all, because I've been making shoestring media for a decade and a half now. And, you know, it's a respectable thing to do in my experience, but if you're going to put the name Michael Moore on it, you can easily get some money to funnel into the project with that name. And it's weird that it seems like such a, you know, seat of the pants sort of effort.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is very surprising on all of those production design elements. And it kind of feels to me like Jeff Gibbs, he really wanted to make this movie because back in, say, 2010 to 2013, you could see a lot of this, what you could frame as hypocrisy of environmental movements, because coal was surging in the US and we were installing solar and was making no dent. And then that all started to change as coal went into decline and we were building out more and more renewable energy. You know, if you go back to that scene in the film when they're at the Volt launch in Michigan and the Michigan grid is more than 90% coal, well, what is it today? It's actually the amount of coal has declined. I wrote that number down, so I'll just pull it up because that was something that I was Googling during the film. Coal now is about 26% of Michigan's power grid, and renewables are about 10%. In 2007, when they were referencing it, it was the absolute peak all time of coal power in Michigan, and it's 40% lower than when they shot that scene. And wind power over that time is now up 1,700 times, right? And so it feels to me like they were making this film that was on a particular narrative, and then reality started to diverge away from it. And so simply updating it was not, let's put an updated data point, let's make a slightly nicer graphic. It was like challenging to the whole core narrative of the project that it seemed like Jeff Gibbs wanted to make. And so that's why they did it that way. And eventually it was just like, yeah, we got to get it out eventually. We've been working on it so long. And so they just kind of threw it out on YouTube.
The longer we sit on it, the less true it is.
Yeah, it's true, because there was a point in time, I don't recall if this was actually pointed out in the film, where Germany was embarking on the Energiewende, energy transition, installing lots of renewable power, also curtailing nuclear, and coal consumption was going up. So that was a point in the pocket of all the people who were criticizing the green energy transition. What has happened since that time in 2014, 2015, everything that the renewable energy transition architects in that country had been planning on happening has happened, and coal is going down. And it's because the film Planet of the Humans is, it's kind of, I guess the way I would phrase it, it's mistaking the territory for the map is how I would put it. Because what it's doing is it's looking at one data point at one point in time and using that to say, well, you know, it's not doing what we wanted it to in the context of green energy transition. When in the reality, everyone who's sitting in the back and who's mapping out what's going to happen to the power grid over 20 and 30 years, none of those data points are surprising. It's like, well, of course we've got to have that happen because we've got a 30-year vision.
Hey, we've been talking really high level and abstract. We should wrap it up pretty soon, but in the final moments, let me just ask you to talk about your own experience. One of being an American from North Carolina living in Canada. You've been there for like a decade, right?
10 years now. Yeah.
So what's it like to look back at the U.S. from your perspective where you are? And, you know, what's your personal experience in this whole pandemic lockdown thing?
Wow. Well, that would be another hour, I think. But, you know, at no point in the last 10 years have I regretted moving to Canada. I truly have liked it here in Vancouver. It's been fantastic. And I do think that on the whole, there's just a lot of positive reasons for me personally to be here. But that's not to say that, everyone's position would be similar. I just think for me, one of the things I wanted to do was go into higher education. And I just didn't feel like the graduate schools in the U.S. presented a fair deal. It was, you know, go into massive debt in order to do it. And Canada offered a way where it was just a lot more affordable. So that was really the driving factor of moving here. And now looking back on it, it was a great move to do. But in terms of the context of the pandemic, I think British Columbia has handled it a little bit different from a lot of other areas. And I attribute a lot of that to people who worked here in our health department who had a lot of experience with SARS back in 2003, and they really learned from their mistakes. And we have a very large Asian community here that takes these kinds of things seriously. And I'm working on my permanent residency here in Canada now that I've graduated and I can do that. And I went to take an English proficiency test just this past week. And so I go in the room and it says online, you know, wear masks and take all these precautions. I was the only white person in that whole test that was wearing a mask, even in pandemic type situation. And I don't know why it's so averse to the culture in white people in North America to just wear a mask in public, but it's what is necessary. And it's just simple steps like that where you take those and it really helps to stop the spread. And when you add to it, a lot of the people who've moved here to Vancouver from China or from Hong Kong have done so with a severe distrust of the Chinese Communist Party. And so when it started ramping in Wuhan and the Chinese Communist Party was presenting one line, a lot of people here did not trust it in any way, and they started making preparations. And I think that has helped specifically in Vancouver and British Columbia to make it where we've had a very flat curve, and it's by no means ever gotten out of control here. But that's a very different story to what's been happening in Quebec, for example.
You know, I just want to comment on the absurdity of you, a native-born American, English is your first language, having to take a test to demonstrate your English proficiency.
True, with a PhD from a Canadian institution in English.
I think maybe something that a lot of people who don't have any experience with the Pacific Northwest, that they just won't realize how significant the Chinese population is in British Columbia. Maybe talk about that for a second.
Yeah, you know, the thing about a city like Vancouver is it's more than half of the population here is from Asian countries. And so it's definitely, I appreciate that just from it's more interesting culturally. And I think that's part of the reason I like staying here is because there's just more that's appealing to me in terms of that interface between Eastern and Western culture, where you get it a lot in Vancouver. And so it definitely helps keep me here. But it's definitely a characteristic of the Pacific Northwest in general.
And if you've been there a decade, then this is going to be your third U.S. presidential election that you've witnessed from afar. What's that been like?
Great. I just have to be honest. I'm so glad. I mean, Canada is intrinsically linked with everything going on in the U.S. So by no means is it an island that is isolated. But what I do not miss in any way is the 24/7 news channel cycle, the talking points, the obsessing over every little thing that one person says on one side or the other, the just rabid like insanity of all people where you can't even have any conversation without triggering people. And here, you know, people are obviously following it very closely, but it's not the same degree of fervor that you get in the United States. And it's like, I can breathe through it. It's not that bad.
You know, Jim Kunstler and I, we have diverged on the topic of collapse, but we're totally simpatico on the topic of the Democrats and the sort of mainstream affluent left in general in the U.S. have gone insane. They've gone just bonkers. And this week, we've gotten word, you know, a pretty definitive reveal that the last 3.5 years of Russia is behind everything. Donald Trump is a Russian agent. Russia bought the 2016 election. It's Russia, 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 Russia. That was all just insanity. And that everybody except Rachel Maddow, who was repeating that, knew that it was insanity for years. And now it's been revealed. I imagine that you're kind of like me in that, you know, growing up, particularly, you know, in North Carolina, Republicans and religious conservatives have been the voice of insanity, you know, for most of my life. It's really weird to be well into a period where the Democratic Party is the party of Wall Street and they are the party of insane conspiracy theories.
It's I got to say, what shocked me about the way that the left narrative evolved post-2016 election was in a direction of conspiracy theory and xenophobia and using and holding up a lot of the styles and tactics of an Alex Jones type personality, but then melding them and folding them back in to that perspective. All the meanwhile, you have Alex Jones type personalities going even further into Crazy Town. And so it's truly
Alex Jones is bragging about his willingness to engage in cannibalism.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where we're at. And it's really sad that we're at a point where truly there can be no moderate in tone discussion of important political issues, because we need it to deal with a fact science-based challenge of a viral pandemic. And I guess if I can close on my thinking about it, the only reason we haven't had a pandemic like this in the past has been primarily due to a greater degree of international cooperation. And the reason I say that is because if you read books, I've long been a fan of Richard Preston's work, and he's written some of the best books about viruses and viral outbreaks in the last 20 or so years. And this pandemic and staying at home more has given me the opportunity to read his most recent book called Crisis in the Red Zone about the 2013-2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And what really stood out about many of the parallels, he published that book in early 2019, and he lays out the exact scenario for New York City of the pandemic if Ebola had come, or if a level 4 virus had come to New York. And he basically closes the book saying it's only a matter of time before it happens, and is very prescient in writing that. But he's an expert, and it's because experts in that field had always seen that scenario on the horizon. What stopped the Ebola pandemic was the international community coming in very quickly early on and trying to curtail the spread. And what we found when virologists looked back at that virus is that it had actually mutated in a very short amount of time to become better at infecting humans, because it had infected so many people. And so in a globally connected world, if you want to have a global economy, you have to be engaged in some degree in problems like that in a cooperative format, because that virus ended up in people who walked the High Line in New York City, who went to hospitals in Texas, and we were very lucky to not have a serious Ebola outbreak in the United States. It came very close, which you see all the details in that book. And other examples are from the bird flu outbreak in Hong Kong in 1997, or swine flu in 2009, and other coronavirus outbreaks like MERS and SARS. And so these outbreaks have been happening on a very regular basis. They just haven't turned into the type of pandemic, partly due to the characteristics of the virus, but also in the way that we've handled it as more cooperative. So that's kind of how I see it.
I have described this pandemic as a pandemic with training wheels.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the death rate is really very, very low. Yeah, we could have had an Ebola pandemic here in North America, and that would have destroyed us. I mean, if this thing, which, you know, has a fatality rate of, you know, maybe 2%, it's unknown at this point. It'll be years before we know what the actual fatality rate is. But, you know, it's surely in the low single digits. Ebola can be 50 to 90% fatality.
Yeah, and actually the big concern over Ebola is that it mutates to become less deadly and more mild, similar to the difference between SARS-1 and current SARS, is the mutation has been towards being more mild cases, or, for example, the MERS coronavirus killing 30% of hosts. You just can't spread rapidly if you're killing your host that much as a virus. Right. So if Ebola were to mutate to only kill 20% of people, it does have the context for a pandemic, because it spreads so readily in terms of contact of, you know, sweat or sitting on a seat where residue was, and so on. So yes, we're very fortunate to have not had a pandemic of a true level 4 type virus, but that doesn't mean that those emerging viruses aren't out there. And this certainly is by no means a worst case scenario for a pandemic.
So final question, you've been home sitting out, you know, observing social distancing. Have you watched Tiger King?
You know what? I have not. I have been truthfully, my life has not changed all that much because I have a little baby who is 8 months old.
Wow.
And it's truly, you know, being able to stay home from work more has actually helped me out. And it's nonstop. So yeah, my ability to watch Netflix or anything has not increased.
Well, I didn't know that. So congratulations.
Thanks.
All right. Hey, Justin, it was great catching up with you.
Yeah, really good to talk to you, KMO, and always happy to come on the show.
All righty. Well, let's not wait. God, how many years has it been?
Yeah, quite a few years.
Yeah. All right. Have a great evening.
You too, KMO.
All right. Unlike you, I have not just listened to the conversation with Justin Ritchie. I edited the whole thing in one go, as I mentioned at the top of the program, and I have not re-listened to it since then. So it's not fresh in my mind, can't really comment on it, and I'm actually wary about saying too much right now, as I don't really want to get worked up again and go off on another rant. As always, I will end the podcast by encouraging you to send me feedback. And in particular, let me just call upon your memory. You know, I've interviewed hundreds of people for the C-Realm podcast and sometimes for The Vault. And of course, you know, I remember the same recurring guests who are almost synonymous with the C-Realm podcast. But I've interviewed lots of other people. Is there any past C-Realm guest that you can think of who you'd really like to hear again? Particularly somebody who isn't necessarily, you know, a public figure or you know, a content creator on their own. Like, sure, you'd love to hear more, another interview with John Michael Greer. But John Michael Greer does podcasts all the time. He doesn't have his own podcast, but he's a regular guest on multiple podcasts. If you want to find some recent material from John Michael Greer, you can. Is there anybody that you remember me talking to for the C-Realm podcast who is not a public figure like that, and who you'd like to hear more from? If any name jumps to mind, send it to me, and I will reach out to them and see if they want to come back and check in. All right, I'm not going to draw this one out. This is the end. Talk to you again soon.